I don't know.
So I don't know how to do that either. So I'm angry. Good afternoon and welcome to Senate Judiciary. Today and tomorrow we have public hearings on all eight of the HJRs that deal with the constitutional proposal for victims' rights. And today, for the first hour, we have proponents. The second hour, those who oppose. And then tomorrow, we begin with the Attorney General and his comments, and then we'll open up for public testimony. So that's our schedule for the next 2 days, and I thought we'd take a break for a couple of days and then ponder it and bring it back and how do we want to do in work session. So with that, then, let us begin with Siegel, and he'll be joined by Kevin Mannix when Kevin gets here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Steve Dole, and I'm president of Crime Victims United of Oregon. In 1996, 59% of the Oregon electorate voted for adoption of Measure 40, which amended the Oregon Constitution so as to guarantee crime victims' rights. By passing Measure 40, Oregon became the 22nd state to guarantee victims' rights in its state constitution. To the extent permitted under the United States Constitution, Measure 40 guaranteed to crime victims the right to be reasonably protected from the criminal defendant throughout the criminal justice process, the right to be present at, to be heard at, and upon specific requests, to be informed in advance of any critical stage of the proceedings, the right to refuse an interview or deposition by the defendant, the right to a public trial without delay by a jury selected from registered voters who have not been convicted of a felony within the previous 15 years, the right to have all relevant evidence admitted against the defendant, the right that criminals should not be permitted to have relevant evidence excluded under the search and seizure laws of Oregon that would be otherwise admissible under the United States Constitution, the right to have 11 jurors render a verdict of guilty on a charge of murder, but not aggravated murder, the right to prompt restitution, the right to allow the court the authority to impose consecutive sentences for crimes involving multiple victims, the right to have the sentence imposed in open court be carried out, and the right to have a copy of a transcript of the proceedings if one is otherwise prepared. In 1998, however, the Oregon Supreme Court invalidated the vote of the Oregon electorate and struck down Measure 40 on procedural grounds in Armada v. Kitzhaber. The Oregon Supreme Court held that initiative measures that amend more than one provision of the Oregon Constitution must be voted on separately. Today, 31 states have amended their state constitutions to include provisions guaranteeing victims' rights. Another 8 states have victims' rights constitutional amendments under consideration. To the extent possible, HJR 87 through 94 are simply a recodification of Measure 40 split into several separate ballot measures in order to comply with the Oregon Supreme Court's decision in Armada v. Kitzhaber. The goals are to guarantee victims' rights by inclusion in the state constitution. Despite the passage of Measure 10 in 1986 and Senate Bill 936 in 1997, many trial judges still ignore crime victims' rights. Examples are victims who continue to be subjected to reprisals by dangerous criminals who are released pre-trial, the refusal of some judges to grant the victim a jury trial, the refusal of some judges to allow victims to give a victim impact statement. Despite the passage of Ballot Measure 10, the Oregon Supreme Court has refused to allow the admission of victims impact evidence during the penalty phase of aggravated murder trials. As long as victims' rights are not included in the state constitution, all conflicts between the rights of the victims and the defendants will be decided in favor of the defendant. To the extent permitted by the United States Constitution, strive to make criminal and juvenile court delinquency proceedings a search for the truth as to the defendant's guilt or innocence. The most fundamental right of crime victims or any citizen is, in fact, the recognition of the truth. Since 1982, Oregon's Supreme Court has engaged in a campaign to expand the rights of criminal defendants under the Oregon Constitution. This has resulted in the exclusion of relevant evidence from criminal and juvenile court delinquency proceedings based on legal technicalities not recognized in most other states or under the United States Constitution. And as a result, victims in Oregon are denied their right to a fair trial. The most common example of the judicial activism by the Oregon State Supreme Court is its interpretation of Article 1, Section 9 of that Constitution. First, it must be recognized that the language of Article 1, Section 9 is based upon the Fourth Amendment of the United States Constitution. The language of the two measures is identical, except that the Fourth Amendment is stated in the present tense, whereas Article 1, Section 9 is stated in the future tense. Second, Oregon courts followed federal search and seizure law from its inception of the state until 1982, so 123 years of state history was followed by those rules. Finally, the action of the Oregon Supreme Court to pursue its own path has resulted in Oregon search and seizure law being convoluted and hyper-technical. As Justice Campbell predicted in his concurring opinion in 1982, the Oregon Supreme Court, quote, departed on a lonely journey in the dark of the moon and against the wind into the quagmire of the law of search and seizure with only reasonableness as its compass. In contrast, federal law has clear, bright lines that are easy to understand for police officers and judges alike. Measure 40 simply returns Oregon to the status that existed before 1982, and H.J.R. 91 specifically is designed to do the same. Finally, legislators should honor the will of the electorate. 59% of Oregon voters cast their ballots to amend the Oregon Constitution to guarantee rights to victims of crime. Legislators who have personal objections should put them aside and allow the Oregon voters the opportunity to decide whether the separate provisions of the Crime Victims' Rights Measure embodied in H.J.R. 87 through 94 should be included in the Oregon Constitution. Now, there's a lot of talk in the last year or so about respecting the will of the Oregon voter. And it's my belief that the very least we can do when we make those statements is to be consistent. And last but not least, I'd like to state that the crime victims groups that support these measures are MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving, an organization that's been in existence for over 20 years and been in existence in the state of Oregon for 18 years. Parents of Murdered Children and Other Survivors of Homicide, a group that has been in existence in the United States for almost 21 years and in Oregon for 18 years. And Crime Victims United, an organization which was formed a little over 17 years ago. So these are three of the longest established victims groups to support these constitutional amendments. I thank you very much for your time, and I'll take any questions you may have of me.
Questions for Smith? I had just a generic one. The measures we have in front of us, how do they differ from Measure 40? If you could walk me through those and just point out if there are differences beginning with H.J.R. 87.
I don't have those measures with me. I'll be quite honest with you, Chair Bryant. That's why I have my colleagues from the the attorneys from the prosecutor's office with me. I can tell you this, that on one of them specifically, the 11-1 jury verdict applies to murder only, but not aggravated murder. And that is the difference from Measure 40. So it's only where there isn't a death penalty case or the chance of life without the possibility of parole.
Other questions? Thank you for testimony. Who would you like to go next then?
Kevin is still out here.
He's still out here.
Well, if you could get Josh Marquis then.
Josh Marquis then.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Josh Marquis. I'm the District Attorney of Clatsop County in Astoria. I'm the Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon District Attorneys Association. And I'm speaking on behalf of that organization as well as on behalf of myself. I would urge this committee and the Oregon State Senate to honor the will of the people that was expressed actually first 13 years ago in 1986, when the first Victims' Rights Bill was passed. And frankly, most Oregonians, if you go and ask them, they think that these rights are already in the Constitution. They usually are horrified when they learn that, in fact, they really aren't guaranteed to them because they haven't been incorporated into the Constitution. It's unfortunate that we were having to go to the point of making these part of the Oregon Constitution, but I don't really think we have any choice if we want to make this clear. I also think it's important to note that this is a crime offense bill. I know it's been characterized by some people as a district attorney's wish list, and that's simply not true. There are a number of things in here that place burdens on district attorneys that maybe all district attorneys aren't all that thrilled about. Things like, for example, providing transcripts or the requirement that district attorneys consult with victims before if they want to talk about a case. Sometimes district attorneys don't want to have to do that, but they should have to. We should have to. Because we not only represent the people of the state of Oregon, but victims play a very special and important role in the criminal justice system, which I think Steve made a good point, has been happening all over the United States. In progressive states like Oregon, I know, likes to think of itself as well as everywhere else. The idea that, of course, criminal defendants have rights, and the United States Constitution and the Bill of Rights and the U.S. Supreme Court have a fine job of protecting those rights. If you look across the river from where I live in Washington, or you travel down to California or Idaho, I don't think you find states there. I don't think you find places where people are denied their rights, and they will not be. I was digging up an old commentary of mine that I wrote back in 1986 in favor of a measure, but it was then Measure 10, and there was an outcry that if Measure 10 passed, civil rights as we know it would come to an end in Oregon. Of course, that didn't happen, and it won't happen if this is brought into effect as well. I can very briefly go through what, as a working prosecutor, and I'm from a fairly small office. I have four deputy DAs and myself. I'm in court myself every week. I just finished an aggravated murder trial 2 weeks ago, and I'll start another one in 2 months. And I probably tried 12 or 13 of those cases. And I have lots of dealings with victims. I've had to sit many, many times with people whose family members have been murdered, women who have been brutalized and raped, and explain to them why this evidence can't come in, why we can't do that. And in some cases, many of these people are well-informed, and they'll say, well, I read about this U.S. Supreme Court decision. And I have to say to them, I'm sorry, we're in the state of Oregon. The Supreme Court decision has no effect here because of the interpretation of the Oregon Constitution. Originally, I know there had been objections because the claim had been that these were all grouped together and they were all being put together as a package. I think it's important to note, to sort of answer Senator Bryan's question, and I don't know the exact differences, that there are a lot of refinements that have come from ballot measure 40 to these. Suggestions that were made by legislative counsel, suggestions that were made as a result of the very vigorous debate that happened over on the House side, and, for example, the 11-1 jury vote on intentional murder cases as opposed to aggravated murder cases. And there's a real serious either misunderstanding or misrepresentation that's been made about that particular provision. I've heard at least one legislator on the other side of the Capitol say that this would mean that you could sentence someone to death with less than 12 votes. That is not possible. It never has been. It's never been the intention that anybody could be found guilty of aggravated murder without the unanimous jury verdict. And Oregon, unlike most states, only requires 10 jurors for a not guilty verdict. In California, it requires all 12 to agree to not guilty. The bail provisions in HCR 90 are important because, for the most part, judges now can only really consider for the most part, the likelihood of a defendant reappearing. And in cases involving particularly domestic violence and child abuse, we often have people who may be otherwise pillars of the community and will present themselves as substantial people, and they may very well appear in court again, but they may pose a very real risk to those victims. And this would say, put in the Constitution, the protection of society and protection of the victims in particular is important. The use of what's called transactional versus youth immunity in HGR 93. One of the reasons that this is very important is most people don't understand that if you have a murder case and you have two or three suspects and you know that one of them, maybe two of them are the killers and one person was maybe standing by. In Oregon, unlike almost every other state, we have to be very careful as prosecutors when we investigate that case. If we compel the testimony of the person, let's say, that we guess was just the bystander, and we give that person immunity, and because there's only transactional immunity, meaning immunity for everything, if we have guessed wrong, we may have just given immunity for the murder to the killer. And so what happens in many cases is those cases do not proceed because no prosecutor wants to take the risk of actually letting a murderer get away with it. Unfortunately, in murder cases, there is no statute of limitations. So many times we'll say, well, let's wait a couple of years, hope some witnesses shake out. I know Senator Bryant can remember a couple of cases when I think even your daughter was a witness in a case that we prosecuted in Deschutes County that was a couple of years old. We waited for that case to come together. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I'm really here as a working prosecutor to tell you that voting for this doesn't even mean that you are supporting the substance of this. It simply means that you're going to allow the voters of Oregon to make another stab at it. And if any of you, individual or collectively, disagree with portions of it, you'll have that opportunity to either vote against it or speak against it. But I think just as with Measure 16, which I know some people opposed, I happen to be a Democrat. I happen to be in favor of Measure 16. I was in favor of Measure 40. I think the voters spoke their will in 40. I think they spoke their will in 16. And I think the voters should have a chance to see it in basically the form in which it was put forward. And that's all I have. If I can answer any questions, I'd be happy to.
Question is for Mr. Marquis. Thank you for your testimony. Who would you like next? Well, Mr. Maddox, Representative Maddox is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Kevin Maddox of Salem. This afternoon, the House treated me like a senator, and they had me in two committees at once trying to vote out bills, so I apologize for being late. Normally, representatives don't get spread around that thin, since we have twice the warm bodies to spread. I appear here today on behalf of HJR 87 through HJR 94. I know you'll be hearing from a number of witnesses in regard to technical perspectives. I'll be happy to answer questions as to those, but I'd like to take a step back and put everything here into context. We have in front of us really eight pieces of what was a single ballot measure. And the reason we have those eight pieces in front of us through eight resolutions is that the Oregon Supreme Court determined that when there is an initiative proposing to amend the Oregon Constitution, that if that initiative has an impact on diverse sections of the Constitution, now whether or not you're going to call it a revision or an amendment, they will look to whether or not it has a substantial impact on more than one part of the Constitution, and if it does, they now say the initiatives have to be broken up and each voted on separately. We'll address some other day, some other time, whether or not referrals will always have to be done that way too by the legislature with the amendments, or whether or not the single subject rule will take care of it. But we do know that in order to avoid any difficulty, the legislature too can refer out these individual pieces safely as separate pieces to allow the voters to vote on eight segments of what was originally a whole. The Victims' Rights Amendment to the Oregon Constitution, I will tell you in a very common sense, open fashion, was clearly designed to reform the justice system. And while some were offended at the notion that it was couched in the terms of victims' rights, it depends on your philosophical perspective as to what victims' rights is all about. To my perspective, victims' rights means a justice system that works so that victims are empowered. And I include in the lexicon of victims society to some extent. You never want to so empower society that the state becomes the be-all and the end-all of the process, but you do want to understand, and you should understand, that society too is harmed by crime. The individual who is murdered or raped or subjected to robbery, is physically directly harmed. The members of that individual's family are somewhat more indirectly harmed. The community is somewhat more indirectly harmed. And the state as a whole, the people of the entire state, are somewhat more indirectly harmed. There's a ripple effect that ripples out across the state every time a crime occurs. So the Victims' Rights Amendment was presented from the perspective of some changes in the justice system to bring about better justice in Oregon. And yes, there were what we've ultimately determined to be 8 components to this. Some of them are the more traditional, and I'll put that in quotes, Victims' Rights, in the sense that many legislatures have sent out to their voters in other states changes to the Constitution to give victims access to the system. But I would give you an example of victims' rights in the context of, say, those who have a physical disability. You can give somebody access to the system by allowing them to get in the room. But the question is whether or not once in the room, you're also going to make sure that the system works around that person, that the person can be interactive with the system. And what I'm getting at is a justice system that works for victims. Not just being able to be in the courtroom, not just being heard or seen, but knowing that the results of the process will be just. Now, when you take that perspective, you can understand then why Measure 40 to some of us was truly a whole. And it was a whole change to the system in a variety of ways. But it was designed to give us a better justice system. Whether or not one agrees with that concept, 59% of the voters bought into it. And yes, probably on individual components, maybe 59% agreed with one piece and 85% agreed with another. I would tell you that I strongly believe that 59% was the lowest common denominator for Measure 40. That when you divide it up and send it out in 8 pieces, you will probably find some pieces of this getting 95% of the vote, and 59% may well be the lowest amount. Because the tendency of the voter will be, when they identify something in a measure that's not too complex, and this wasn't, not too long, and this wasn't, to see something that they don't like, and to hear arguments about something that they don't like, well, I'm going to vote no on this because they displeased me as to this piece. And then you move on from there. Perhaps some gave the benefit of the doubt to some provision or the other and went on and voted yes. Maybe the lowest common denominator is 55%. However, what we do know is 59% voted for this measure. We also know that the Supreme Court revisited their view of how initiatives such as this are presented and came up with a new interpretation that said we're invalidating this process. This leaves the legislature with a challenge as to whether or not we want to allow the voters to have a chance to revisit those issues. I would encourage you to keep that concept in mind. And yes, as legislators, you need to exercise independent judgment as to whether or not something is viable and doable and appropriate. I would never expect less. But in making that determination, I would hope you would keep in mind the notion that you give some accommodation to the voters and some accommodation to what they have already done. There are those who, in the name of victims' rights, will come to you with a washed-out, watered-down, bleached-out version of parts of Measure 40. And I would encourage you to avoid that temptation. Now that these pieces have been divided up into 8 separate referrals, the voters will have an opportunity to hear the argument as to whether or not what they passed in the first place in separate pieces should be repassed. And I think that is challenge enough to the system and opportunity enough to the system, and that the voters ought to be given that accommodation, that amount of respect, if you will, for something that they did pass. I would encourage you, too, to take a look at the preamble in each of these pieces and respect the fact that there is a need for a preamble in each piece. We heard argument in the House that, oh, no, we only need a preamble for the real victims' rights piece, HCR 87. The rest really shouldn't have this preamble, and I say no to that. Because the Oregon Supreme Court has made it very clear that they take a literal approach now towards reading constitutional provisions and reading the statute. They avoid getting to legislative intent. The PGD case has made that clear. So unless you have the total literal piece there, you run the risk that the court will determine that they're not going beyond that actual language, right up to the edge of absurd results, by the way, based on some recent decisions that I've seen, because they think the language means what it says, and they're not going to go beyond that unless they find a patent ambiguity. Why, then, do we need to have the preambles? Because the preambles literally create context for every single one of these 8 resolutions. And they will be in front of the voters, they will be on the ballot, and they will be passed or not to create a context for each measure. Take out that context,
weaken the measure right then and there because the intent is no longer being stated. Secondly, we heard arguments in the House that really we ought to take these pieces and blend them into existing constitutional provisions. I again urge you to avoid that temptation for two reasons. One, you create the perception, perhaps, that what we're doing is revising the Constitution rather than amending it. And frankly, I do not want to give the Oregon Supreme Court the paper argument that by blending some words into an existing provision in the Constitution, what we've done is a revision. Why? Because that takes a two-thirds vote of the House and a two-thirds vote of the Senate to send out to the voters, as opposed to a majority vote for an amendment. By taking a clear, clean amendment approach where you're adding a section to the Constitution, it is clear then that it is an amendment. It's not a revision. You're not changing any of the existing language. Take one word out of existing language, take a comma out, and you've created a lawyer's argument that it's a revision. Add a section to the Constitution that affects only one concept in the Constitution. And based on the Supreme Court's more recent decisions, we can honestly say it's an amendment. It's a majority of the Senate, a majority of the House, and a majority of the people. The second reason is context again. If you try to blend in a provision, such as the right to trial by jury, into the current constitutional language, you are opening the door to free-flow interpretation based on all of the prior decisions that have existed as to current constitutional language, and also a free-flow as to whether or not we fit into that existing language in some special way. Whereas if you do what is done in these resolutions and you create your own separate amendment, that amendment speaks for itself. The lawyer's term for this is impari materia. You read something in the context of the rest of the material. The context we are presenting to the voters is the preamble to each and the actual addition to the Constitution. So there's no muss or fuss about what's presently in the Constitution. The piece speaks for itself. And having spoken for itself empowers the people and empowers those who've made the referral to the people. That is important, I think, and when you hear arguments about blending it into the Constitution, I ask you to keep that in mind. Well, we'll blend these concepts into the Constitution by adding them, but we're not going to fool around with existing language. We'll leave that alone. Now, each of these measures addresses one of the eight elements of Measure 40. I am sensitive to the amount of time that the committee is willing to devote to this, and I appreciate the fact that a substantial amount of your very limited time is being devoted to this. I would ask the chair whether you would like me to run through each of these briefly and describe what it does and the reasons for it.
I would, because just for my clarity, for instance, I believe you begin with number 87, and the preamble or the subsection 1, paragraph 1, is the same preamble on all of them, correct?
Essentially, there are some minor modifications to make it fit the context of the given measure.
When you come to those with the minor modifications, if you can point those out. And I have to step out in the hallway for a second, but Kevin, what I have an interest in is, for instance, under paragraph, subparagraph A, where upon specific request, any critical stage of the proceeding, when the defendant will be present, how do you define a critical stage?
My short answer, Mr. Chairman, will be that we have deliberately used some phraseology that we think ought to be left to court interpretation over time and application, because we don't think every stage of the proceeding that might be critical can be predefined. And we're not afraid of having the courts make some of those determinations as to what is the critical stage of the proceeding. Although I think some of the stages are pretty obvious. I'd say trial is a critical stage of the proceeding. Sentencing is a critical stage of the proceeding. Pre-trial motions to exclude are critical stages of the proceeding. Critical meaning an aspect of the proceeding in which the capability of the case to proceed can be at risk. Even arraignment can be considered in certain circumstances a critical stage of the proceeding. Sometimes arraignment is a fairly perfunctory process. Other times, it's a very significant process. And sometimes, I would say one will have to err on the side of caution. The point being, really, that the victim ought to be able to be there any time you have an open court proceeding and to be able to be present there and to be observant of that proceeding.
Yes, correct.
as you walk through each of the levels, the other things that I'd be curious in addition to the changes from ballot measure 40 is what other states have that particular provision. And my other question is, in light of your concern about making sure that we keep the preamble, because you're concerned about judges' observed results in some recent cases, then are you going to support the overruling the PGE case?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I said to the edge of absurdity, and I think the Court of Appeals itself made reference to that in a recent case, that they are being forced by literal interpretation to the edge of absurdity, and that they're no longer able to rely on some old bromide that we used to rely on, that legislation should be interpreted in such a fashion as to avoid an absurd result. The Court of Appeals has recently complained, and I can't name the case, but I saw the synopsis that they're no longer allowed to rely on that bromide decision.
Young versus State of Oregon.
Mm-hmm. So you support the overruling the PGE decision?
I certainly would.
Well, going back just to A, and I know we're developing legislative history here, subparagraph A, I understand critical stage, and then it says we'll be present and to testify. How does that work out, though, when a court determines that I'm going to exclude witnesses? Or potential witnesses based upon a motion, because the court says to guarantee a fair trial, I don't want witnesses to be influenced by other witnesses say. How would you handle that in that situation with this subparagraph?
Generally speaking, Mr. Chairman, I'd say that the victim has as much right to be there as the defendant. And since defendants are not excluded because they might testify, victims should not be excluded because they might testify.
And then on that line 14, if the DA doesn't want the victim there, or the DA doesn't want to call the victim as a witness because they feel they're a bad witness and might jeopardize the case or for whatever reason, does the DA retain the prerogative to do that?
Yes, and I'm checking the particular language on this one because we've provided here that we're covering both, first of all, criminal and juvenile proceedings. Excuse me. And at page 2, we talk about the generic victim that I've discussed before, beginning at line 14, which is the A and verse HGR 87, and in the event no person suffers like harm. We have the people of Oregon also as a generic victim. But other than the exclusion of a criminal defendant, we're covering all victims here. And normally speaking, although in this particular one, I'm not running across the DA language, which is run across to some of the other provisions, the idea is that the DA still represents the people as a generic victim. The individual victim is also handled through the district attorney. The idea is that the district attorney has to be the advocate for the public and for the people, and the victim is going to be, in effect, indirectly represented through the district attorney. The intent is not that the victim gets to walk into court and take over the proceedings. Now,
but if the DA does not want the victim to testify and the victim wants to testify, what happens then?
It's a good question, Mr. Chairman. My answer would be that the DA is the prosecutor of the case and is in charge of the presentation of the evidence to the prosecution. There's no provision here that allows the victim to prosecute the case, and should the victim wish to be heard in terms of testimony, and the district attorney does not wish to present the victim's testimony, the victim's only alternative would be to turn to the defense attorney to see whether or not the defense would like to call the victim. Now, this is a good example, though, of something, Mr. Chairman, where if a question arises, one can put in a qualifier to say that the district attorney who needs to make those ultimate determinations about the representation of the victim at the trial. That is the kind of qualifier that fits in with Measure 40, where generically in Measure 40, it's for the district attorney is the person to assert the rights on behalf of the victim. And if in this particular measure any qualm arises as to whether or not that's clear, one could add a specific proviso that the district attorney is the person who ought to assert those rights or who represents the victim in that sense. And that would protect from that kind of question or problem.
Senator Duncan.
Chair, that question and answer made me a bit concerned. about why this is constitutional rather than statutory. I mean, because it's at this point you say, well, I think, and so forth, and there may be some things that have to be adjusted. You put something in the Constitution that's extremely difficult to do. Why would not statutory? Of course, I suppose the reason you wouldn't want to statutory is because it could be changed then, too.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, the generic rationale for putting this in the Constitution, actually there's two elements of it. One is, yes, it makes it harder to change, and we would like to make it harder to change. Secondly, though, in this state, because of the interpretations of the Oregon Constitution, some of these victims' rights need to be in the Oregon Constitution to be considered co-equal to defendants' rights. And for example, the right of the victim to be present throughout the trial, even if the victim's going to be testifying, I would suggest that the Oregon Supreme Court would say if that was a statutory right, as it is, by the way, since Measure 40 was substantially implemented through statute, the court will make a balancing test and decide from time to time, well, we're going to exclude the victim in this case because the victim might testify and the victim's testimony might be affected by their capability to see and hear other witnesses, so they'll go through a balancing process. If it's in the Constitution, the victim's rights are co-equal with the defendant's right to be present. And I cannot discern a situation, maybe there's one in extraordinary circumstances, where the court could justify excluding the victim from the courtroom. I would add quickly that in the civil context, we do this all the time. I represent civil defendants and civil plaintiffs, and both parties get to have somebody present in the courtroom throughout the trial, even if that person's going to testify. They get to see and hear everything. But when it comes to a criminal prosecution, the only person right now who's guaranteed the right to be there all the time in terms of someone who may testify, is the defendant. This, in effect, guarantees the victim that right, and it would necessarily be a constitutional right. Some of these remaining provisions, again, we do write, and the other HDRs write to the level of the need to put it in the Constitution to make sure it's co-equal with constitutional defendant's rights.
Okay. There was just some three women who have been found in Forest Park, and as a result, most of the women I know that run up in that area are extremely concerned about being under there. So as I read this, we've suffered direct psychological harm as a result of that particular crime. Are you intending that we would all be entitled to notice, et cetera, of assuming they get the criminal? Are you intending that we'd be entitled to notice and all the particular rights that you set forth here?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, no. I'm sorry to say this to you, but actually knowing of a crime, being aware of a crime, that's public knowledge, does not make you a victim in that direct sense. There's a reason for the term direct. If you're the sister or mother or daughter or husband or boyfriend, and you suffer, and you come in and you say, this person was murdered, I'm a family member. I shouldn't even say boyfriend, I'd include family members. You've suffered direct financial, psychological, or physical harm. The rest of the world has suffered indirect harm. And that includes those who may feel a very strong psychological impact, but it's still indirect rather than direct.
I think it includes, for example, them gay and lesbian partners.
And yes. I was asked to explain the preamble, and I wasn't sure how far the chairman wanted me to go into it, but I'll go through it once on this first piece, and then we'll find out how much differentiation is needed on the other HDRs. Phrase by phrase, to preserve and protect the right of crime victims to justice, there's the universal concept, to ensure crime victims a meaningful role in the criminal and juvenile justice system. Keywords there are meaningful and role. Not just passive witnessing of the process, but some role, which is meaningful. And we are including the juvenile justice system here, not just the adult criminal justice system. There are other measures which make a distinction and include only the adult justice system. To accord crime victims due dignity and respect, important concepts that we're trying to emphasize here, and to ensure that criminal and juvenile court proceedings, again, juvenile court delinquency proceedings, are bringing in both of those concepts here, are conducted to seek the truth as to the defendant's innocence or guilt. There is the ultimate test, the truth as to the defendant's innocence or guilt. That is the ultimate objective of the process, even though we talk about victims' rights. the most important right is to justice and to truth, not to vengeance, and also to ensure that a fair balance is struck between the right of Christ of crime victims and the rights of criminal defendants. This is where we get into the reason for having this in the Constitution, the balancing test, the consideration of the victims as well as the defendants, in the course and conduct of criminal proceedings. So we're not just talking about the external process, but the actual process within the court. The following rights are hereby granted to victims in all prosecutions for crime. And then you pick up with the specific listing of rights. I think that they speak for themselves, but I'll give you an example of where we differed with the minority report in the House, and there's a reason for difference. If you drop down to sub E on line 23, the right to have a copy of a transcript of any court proceeding in open court if one is otherwise prepared. We wrote that pretty carefully. One, we didn't say whether or not she had to pay for it. Somebody may give it to you. The court may decide to give it to you. Fine. We also didn't say you couldn't be required to pay for it. The court may decide that 5,000-page transcript, that you really don't need to have it without paying for it. We've left that piece open to interpretation, whereas the minority report we dealt with on the House said you had to pay for it. Well, come on. The judge may decide that you don't have to pay for it. But it says if one is otherwise prepared. So we've limited in the sense that the transcript doesn't have to be prepared just to take the victim because they want one. If there is a transcript, then you can get a copy. The consultation in plea negotiations in sub F, lines 25 and 26. Please note that you have to make the request, first of all. This isn't the generic thing that happens. And then you have the right to be consulted. It doesn't say the right to approve or deny or modify, but just the right to consultation. Careful choice of language. And we limit it to violent felonies.
As you're going through that, I'm going back to my question about who is a victim and who suffers direct financial, psychological, physical harm. Who makes that determination? Do we need a hearing on that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, generally speaking, I think, fortunately, in the vast majority of cases, there won't be any issue. It will be pretty clearly understood who the victims are.
By whom? And the reason I ask that is because I really feel that the fact that the women's bodies that were found in Forest Park affect me. They affect the women that I know that run up there. I mean, we have direct harm because we use the park, and now we're afraid.
And, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, my response is that you asked my interpretation before. My interpretation was, no, that doesn't fit. One can always apply to the court and give an instance, I suppose, and say, I want to be considered a victim. Ultimately, it's the decision of the court, which is in charge of the proceedings, to make that determination. I would hope that generally that would not require much of an adjudication process. The right to be present is established now in something like 38 states, to answer an earlier question that was alluded to. And I'm not aware of any real difficulty. And by the way, we have the statutory rights right now, and I'm not aware of any great difficulty in defining who a victim is. But I suppose from time to time, if a group came in and said we want to be considered victims, and there's some objection from the defendant, or the prosecution said, I really don't think these are victims that I'm representing on this matter, then the court would have to make that determination. I'd suggest it'd be as summary as any other determination that needs to be made by the court in the daily conduct of proceedings.
Here's a situation on victim. Let's say that it's a situation where it's a rape. And in my first scenario, the victim is a minor. And the parents say, we want to be considered victims, too, because she's a minor and she lives in our house. In that scenario, would the parents also then be considered victims?
Yes.
Let's say then, same situation, except the daughter is an adult, doesn't live with the parents. And the parents say, we want to be considered victims. Would they be considered victims?
Well, and if I may, Mr. Chairman, in fact, we allude to this in line 13 and 14 of page 2 of H.R. 87, which we say, in the case of a victim who is a minor, the legal guardian of the minor, which in most cases is the parents that have custody, although occasionally it can be somebody else, that would suggest that once somebody is not a minor, first of all, you don't normally have a legal guardian, but you might have a legal guardian from an adult. And I'd say that if that was the case and the adult was victimized, the legal guardian would probably be able to come in and say, I ought to be treated as a victim. A direct family member for someone who's a subject of physical violence ought to be able to appear as a victim. That would include, by the way, a member of the household who has a close relationship. And it will require a common sense interpretation from case to case. I will say that part of this will also involve what kind of right is being asserted. For instance, if you have someone who asserts this right and they're the third cousin twice removed as a victim, and they're a potential witness, I think that the court would say, well, you know, I'm not about to award the level of victimhood or recognize the level of victimhood that you're asserting because you're a distant family relation, and I'm trying to balance the constitutional rights of victims against the constitutional rights of defendants, so we're not going to allow you to be present because you're a potential witness. That is the kind of balancing test that at least like judges conduct when you get apart from the obvious victim. 95% of the time, there's not going to be any question about who the victim is or who are what I'll call closely related victims.
In the second scenario where the daughter is an adult not living at home, if she said, I do not want my parents considered as victims, I don't want them being involved as a victim in the trial, what impact would that have?
Twofold, Mr. Chairman. There will be times when, for instance, if the daughter was a minor, that wouldn't make a difference because the parents are already defined as victims if they have custody or legal guardianship. In the adult situation, I think that the question is what sort of nexus the parents can establish if they're coming and saying they want to be considered victims. I don't think the direct physical victim has veto power over the victimhood of others. The court has to look to the assertions of others and what nexus they have, either financially, psychologically, or physically, to the individual. And those are distinctions that will have to be visited by the court from time to time in a common sense real world.
And then the other dilemma the DAs might have is when they give the notice, if it's practical, who would they notify? Well, it'll be the obvious situation where there's one or two victims. But in no event, if the notice isn't given, it doesn't give a cause of action against the DA for failure to give it, nor does it invalidate in any way the trial, so that the defense couldn't raise it as I don't know how they would, but I imagine someone could be creative and said, because you denied the constitutional rights of the victim, my conviction should be overturned.
And the intent is, if I may, Mr. Chairman, the defendant will never be able to avail themselves of victims' rights as a sword or as a shield. That's really something that the victim gets to attend to. And we also are assuming good faith and practicality on the part of the district attorneys, who are the ones who really have to carry the brunt of implementing these measures, and I'm pleased to say also support them. So those who carry the most obligation under these measures are also among the most supportive of them.
And would it come out of the DA's budget for the cost of the transcript?
It would, Mr. Chairman, it would actually, since there is no requirement that the victim pay or not pay, it will depend on the generosity of the budgetary process.
But if the court says you can have a transcript at low cost, who would normally assume that cost?
The finance chairman, the provider of the transcript, which may well be the district attorney.
Yes, sir. Fair enough.
Lines 19 and 20 at page 1, where it's the right to refuse an interview, deposition, or other discovery request by the criminal defendant. Another person, do you anticipate any problems in that situation? Is a material fact involved that only the victim knows, and that's withheld from the defendant? And that there's a subsequent appeal on the basis that this material fact, which may lead to other evidence, was not presented?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, I don't anticipate a problem because actually this is basically current law and practice. We're just enshrining it in the Constitution, and we have not run into any substantial problems that I know with this provision. Although I have not prosecuted a criminal case in about 20 years, so I better not be too glib about responding on that one.
I mean, is there, that's alarming. You can't depose a witness? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman? If I may, the prosecutors can speak to this, but I'm advised that actually victims are given special shields and protections right now, and this is before Measure 40 even in certain respects, as to what they have to be put through pre-trial, and that there is severely limited access to victims as to the pre-trial proceedings.
How about one of the victims that is a peripheral victim, like a relative of some sort? I mean,
Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, that at some point will be entered into the realm of a determination by the judge as to whether or not this person has substantial enough status of victimhood to be protected by the constitutional provision.
I think what's going to happen is the trial court's going to have to weigh the fundamental rights guaranteed by the U.S. Constitution due process to a fair trial versus this. And, for instance, my first question to you about excluding witnesses, I would believe that the judge, if he determined it was necessary for a fair trial, could exclude the victim or the victims.
Mr. Chairman, you're exactly right, and I perhaps should have mentioned earlier, that's exactly why we have the specific understanding and representation in each of these measures. Nothing in this section reduces the criminal defendant's rights under the Constitution of the United States. But we are saying that the Oregon Constitution would not be read so as to create some sort of conundrum here. It's the United States Constitution provisions that certainly have to be honored, and we're recognizing that specifically here. And if there is a balancing to be applied, obviously the United States Constitution rights to due process and a fair trial have to be honored. And that may be, there may be a situation, Mr. Chairman, that I can't imagine right now but could arise, where a victim might be prevented from having the opportunity to be in court. We've already covered the situation where the victim is himself or herself also a criminal defendant, that they're trying to claim victimhood and to gain some access. There could be other circumstances that we have not foreseen where the judge would simply say, I think that your right to due process is for the defendant is being undermined by the presence of the victim.
I guess the what Senator Nelson raises, and it's a good point, is if I didn't want to be interviewed by defense counsel and I had some collateral involvement in it, I could say, I'm a victim, I don't have to talk to you. And then you could, the defense attorney would have to file a subpoena request or something to bring the issue before a judge and you determine whether or not you were in fact a victim.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. Those issues would have to be brought before the judiciary. The beauty of this measure and all of the others, though, is that it forces us to confront these choices and to consider these from a perspective of society, the victim, and the defendant, whereas the current constitutional scheme is really, in the minds of some of us, more aimed towards the consideration of the defendant to the exclusion of others, and we're requiring that to be more balanced.
Well, if I witness something, I will say I witnessed a violent crime. And I knew the victim. And it was very upsetting and life-changing to me. Could I assert that I was, in fact, myself a victim and refused to talk to defense counsel?
You could, Mr. Chairman, you could make that assertion, and I think then the court will have to get into that due process balancing approach as to availability as a witness. The range of victimhood, and I've mentioned the ripple effect, you move from the actual direct physical victim of a crime all the way to the periphery where society in general is harmed by crime, is also paralleled by the range of involvement of witnesses, although it's a narrower range, I suppose. People who may be physically present, people who may not have been physically present but came upon the scene just before or after. We've recognized, however, in the civil law, the psychological impact of traumatic events on other people. And this is what we're trying to do here, too, is to recognize there can be a severe psychological impact on others.
But in recognizing that, we give them a cause of action. We don't prohibit them from being interviewed by the defense counsel for the insurance company.
Well, in fact, Mr. Chairman, again, I'd say that the one qualifier that may be helpful here would be to provide that it's the district attorney who asserts the rights on behalf of the victim. And then you've added a common sense, objective relief valve so that you avoid those kinds of issues, because the attorney, the prosecutor who wants to have a successful prosecution in this case, any given case, will be pretty careful about not overasserting rights on behalf of the victim.
Right, and I think they'd want that. Otherwise, the DA could lose control of the case, or his conviction could be threatened because he violated the constitutional right to a fair trial. Okay, should we go on to 88?
Chairman, H.J.R. 88
has a preamble which talks about the criminal justice system. And I mention that because the preamble is a little bit different from the preamble to H.C.R. 87.
If you take a look at the body of H.C.R. 88, there is a discussion here as to the district attorney authorized to assert or waive the right established, that's in subsection 3. The key provision is in subsection 1. The people of the state of Oregon have the right to a public trial by a jury without delay in any criminal prosecution. This excludes juvenile delinquency proceedings where there is no jury trial. That's a trial, in effect, to the judge, and it's not considered a criminal proceeding, it's a delinquency proceeding. Basically, what SGR 88 says is that we are recognizing that while the defendant has a right to demand a jury trial and can waive that right, the people, too, have a right to a public trial by a jury. This is the one HDR that talks about the people as opposed to a specific victim, in the sense that we wanted to recognize that every case involving a crime does include the concept that a trial by jury may be a necessary element to achieve justice from the perspective of the people. And this is a perfectly balanced process. The defendant can demand the right to trial by jury, and nobody can take that away. That's already in the Constitution. And the people can demand the right to trial by jury, and nobody can take that away. Either side can waive it, but neither side can be forced to waive it. And this has to do with any criminal prosecution.
Yes, you said, you specifically said it did not include juvenile delinquency proceedings. Why not?
Because there are no jury trials in juvenile delinquency proceedings. Mr. Chair?
Yes,
correct. Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, because with the juvenile justice reform movement of the last 50 years, the movement was towards treating the child as a ward of the court, and the process was set up so that the system is designed to protect the best interests of the child, and it was moved away from any kind of a criminal adjudication. Over time, there's been changes that have been made to make sure, for instance, the juvenile has certain rights as to self-incrimination, the right to representation by an attorney. But the U.S. Supreme Court and the Oregon Supreme Court have both recognized that there is no jury trial right in the juvenile delinquency proceeding. There is also, generally speaking, a limitation on the sanctions which can be imposed in juvenile proceedings. Certain juveniles cannot be subjected to the death penalty. And under our system in Oregon right now, you cannot be held beyond the age of 25 if you've been adjudicated in juvenile, 25 in a juvenile proceeding. We're not talking measure 11, that's an adult court proceeding.
Mr. Chair, yes. So you're not intending that the impact of all of these resolutions result in juveniles having access to juvenile trials?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, not at all.
Okay.
In fact, I don't mind saying that the intent is to maintain a firm distinction between juvenile delinquency proceedings and adult criminal proceedings.
Except measure 11, because that is an adult court.
That's an adult court proceeding.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, Brown.
Then why did you include, with respect to 87, then, why did you include juveniles in the rights provision?
Because in, Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, in H.R. 87, we do want consultation as to what's going on in terms of plea bargaining, because the reality is plea bargaining does occur in the juvenile context. We do want the right to be present during adjudication. That's a different context. But the jury trial right is purely an adult trial context, and we do recognize that.
Well, let's quickly move to the 88. Any other states have this provision that you're aware of?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, off the top of my head, I don't know.
Thank you.
On line 11, it says without delay. Are you thinking of that having the same meaning as a speedy trial from the defendant's standpoint?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I just had whispered in my ear that 35 other states have the state's right to a jury trial. I can only speak to it indirectly, having had it passed on to me, but I'm for that piece of information. The idea of without delay here is a little different, Mr. Chairman, and I'd be cautious about that. The idea is that we do have a system which assumes to a certain amount that defendants want an adjudication promptly, But the reality is that sometimes they don't. I mean, there's a tendency of delay, and at some point, there under this provision, there can be a balancing saying, wait a minute, this case will proceed. There is, the public does have a right to say that this case will be adjudicated without delay. It always has to be considered in the due process and fair trial context. But this does empower the judges to, in some cases, be more aggressive about saying enough is enough, we're going to proceed with this case. Statutorily, we've had a lot of implementation language in Oregon about this both ways anyway. This does not harm that, but it does buttress it.
Other questions on 88? Turning that to HCR 89.
Mr. Chairman, HCR 89, again, focuses on the criminal justice system because we're talking about the trial process with a jury, and the jury trial process only applies to adult criminal trials. It does not apply to juvenile delinquency proceedings. The concept behind HCR 89 is fairly simple. We want criminal juries to be composed of responsible citizens who are focused on the good of society and the rights of the defendant and the rights of the victim. And to that end, we return to the pre-1989 Oregon requirements for jury service, which is, A, you should not be a convicted felon, at least within the previous 15 years, and B, you're chosen from among those who have registered to vote. I would mention parenthetically that that is presently the requirement for jury trials as the criminal juries until July 1, when the statutory implementation measure 40 expires after this. But the and this is one of the hotly debated pieces from the House side. There seems to be less challenge to the notion of felons being on a jury than there is to the notion of the jury pool from whom you select your jurors. On the felon side, I would mention that the most important part of this, I think, has to do with the grand jury proceedings. Because in a petit jury trial, in the actual jury trial where the jurors are present and the facts are being adjudicated, at least the defense and the prosecutors have a chance to have certain jurors removed for cause. And one would think that for cause would often involve, hey, this person's been convicted of a felony, they're not going to be able to be very fair, so you can get them off. But we have had grand juries with felons sitting on them, and that is hardly conducive to the justice process, and this would prevent that. It would also say, though, that if you've been convicted of a felony, we're just assuming that for at least 15 years, you haven't gotten over it in terms of how you feel about things. And I would add that there is a nice parallel here. It is currently also against the law for a felon to possess a firearm for 15 years. So we're saying if we won't trust you with a gun, we also won't trust you with a jury. The registered voter provision comes to the old-fashioned concept of citizen participation in the community. And it is a value choice, a policy choice, which Oregonians have made actually through the legislative process again until 1989, when the legislature went through the motor voter system of change at the voter registration and also said, by the way, we'll use the motor vehicle pool as our pool for potential jurors. The policy choice here has to do with how do you effectuate having responsible citizens on the jury. These are criminal juries only. This does not apply to civil juries. But in every single criminal case, a person's liberty is at stake. And the perspective of HCR 89 is any time a person's liberty is at stake, the people who are judging that case as to the facts, determining the facts of the case, ought to have been responsible enough to have at least sent a 33-cent stamp to register to vote by mail to participate in the civic process. So that's what that measure is all about.
Yes, exactly.
You mentioned a kind of a jury, and I didn't catch that word.
The petit jury, that's sort of an old-fashioned phrase. There's a grand jury and the petit jury, and the grand jury is a jury that goes through the indictment process. The petit jury is actually the trial jury. I haven't even heard that term used in quite a while. I just looked it up into my conscience.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, Brad.
I got a letter from the Access to Justice Law Committee, and their promise is that we believe that limiting the source list would systematically reduce the number of young adults, minorities, and people from lower income levels from the pool of potential jurors. I guess I'd like to address that comment. Are you saying that the motor vehicle, that folks that drive cars are not responsible and registered voters are?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, relatively speaking, yes. I will mention that we had a special extension of our work sessions on the HDR because former Justice Peterson asked to come in and make a special presentation on this issue, and we brought in that letter and his testimony, and we had already heard testimony before on this point, but we wanted to be particularly sensitive to his perspective, and we did hear him out on this.
And he'll be here today, too.
Oh, okay.
In the room.
Our reaction was simply this. If we want diversity in juries, juries are supposed to reflect those who are involved in the community. The answer is to get diversity in the voter pool. And if our voter pool is not diverse, then there's something wrong with our system. If there's something wrong with our system, you fix the system, you get people involved, you get them to register to vote. But you don't trump the system by saying, well, even though you haven't registered to vote, we're going to have you engage in what is probably your most important civic duty, serving on a jury, when you're not willing to engage in a less, well, I would say, relatively speaking, less important civic duty.
Very important.
The one thing I must say about this argument, and I use it all the time, but having walked recently, where you had the voter list, as you know, at least I did, which had a complete readout on the history of everybody's door you're about to knock on. The number of individuals who had not voted in the last 100 years is very surprising. I just never thought I'd have to tell you about it. I mean, like, Peter, we're not going to the door, why not? Because, Peter, they hadn't voted since D.C. And so I just have to tell you that just because they registered, you know, the number of them who just don't vote, in some ways, I don't know whether they just equal to the person who doesn't register or not, but that's why
The other factor in it, in 1988, I was in charge of a school bond issue, and it was to get out the vote, and we're going after the yes voters, and we contacted every school employee, we contacted every parent, asked them to vote yes, and about 15% were not signed up to vote. And the reason they gave most often was they didn't want to be called for jury duty. So I had the pleasure of telling them, well, you're going to get called anyway because it comes from the DMV records. And they were really disheartened to hear that. But that is an issue.
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the remedy there can be found in Marion County in a model which is now being emulated, I believe, in Multnomah County, which is, why don't they want to serve on the jury? Because the jury system for service was antiquated and unfair and a waste of a lot of people's good time. The reform of the jury service system in Marion County has been very successful. This isn't a presentation on that, but I would just mention that the way to do this is to fix it. You make, in effect, everybody have to participate to some extent and to serve for one trial or to be on call for one trial, and then you take them off the hook and you call them the day before. And I know because I've been through it now. And I was happy to be run through the process and end up I was not called in to be a juror. But all I had to do a couple of times was call in after 5 o'clock and find out whether my case was proceeding the next day. And when I found out I didn't have to go to the courthouse. I didn't have to sit around. So there are some reforms that ought to be done that are being implemented and as to why people try to avoid jury service. But we are back to there's two philosophical questions here. One is that we simply allow the voters to revisit that which they've already passed, which is the two provisions in this HDR about who serves on a jury. And the second is, do we challenge ourselves to entice folks to participate more in the voting process? And I think we need to challenge ourselves. And actually, sending these kinds of wonderful resolutions to the voters should encourage voter participation because it empowers the people and gives them a sense of participation in democracy.
Why don't we go to number 90?
Thank you. HDR 90 has to do with the protection of the victim end of society in the making of pretrial release decisions. I will say that substantively, in terms of the modifications that have occurred here, this has probably been more dramatically changed compared to a number of the other sections from the original measure 40. And this was done in consultation with a number of folks, including some folks in the Attorney General's office, who encouraged us to look to the Federal Bail Reform Act provisions for some direction as to tightening up the language. So HCR 90 contains a tighter set of language as to pretrial release considerations in favor of release and against detaining somebody compared to the original Measure 40. In other words, it's easier about release compared to Measure 40. The key concept is that we're talking, again, now criminal proceedings, not juvenile adjudication. We're talking about the criminal justice system in the preamble. And here, it's the protection of the victim from the criminal defendant or the convicted criminal throughout the criminal justice process. And now we do include this part for the juvenile part, the alleged youth offender or abuse offender throughout juvenile delinquency proceedings. We've again recognized that as a separate kind of proceeding, so we've bifurcated that in sub A here. So in a sense, when we talk about the criminal justice system in the preamble, I guess you could say that includes juvenile proceedings, but we do try to distinguish between those two when we talk about the implementation language. The pretrial release standards are contained here, particularly in sub B, as to the criminal defendants, not the juvenile adjudication folks, but the criminal defendants. And we talk about the principle of reasonable protection of the victim and the public, as well as, this is in the conjunctive, not the disjunctive, as well as the likelihood that the criminal defendant will appear for trial, which has been the more traditional concept that applies as to bail. We use some fairly traditional language that's already close to what's in the Constitution. Murder, aggravated murder, and treason shall not be bailable when the proof is evident or the presumption strong that the person is guilty. That's pretty much the current constitutional standard in those cases. Next, we turn to violent felonies, which are later defined. Other violent felonies shall not be bailable when, and here's your process, a court has determined there is probable cause to believe the criminal defendant committed a crime, and the court finds by clear and convincing evidence, which is just below beyond a reasonable doubt, by clear and convincing evidence that there is danger of physical injury or sexual victimization to the victim or members of the public by the criminal defendant while on release. In effect, this person is dangerous, and there is probable cause to believe that this person committed the crime. So in finding that the person is dangerous, it has to be by clear and convincing evidence. The application in sub 2 says it applies to criminal and, as appropriate, juvenile court delinquency proceedings. So we've tried to make it clear that the juvenile court proceedings are going to have to be differentiated, and judges are going to have to make a determination as to when this ought to apply in the juvenile context. We want to leave the flexibility for all time that the juvenile justice system can be different and the appropriateness of the application can be different. And again, of course, we do emphasize the U.S. constitutional protections which ought to be maintained. We have the definition of victim, which we've already discussed before, but we also have a clarification or a definition for this one as to violent felony. It means a felony in which there is an actual or threatened serious physical injury or a felony sexual offense. Serious physical injury is drawn from the context of the current criminal justice code, and that is as opposed to physical injury. To get into the violent felony category, to be considered for the restrictions here, there has to have been a crime involving serious physical injury or a felony sexual offense. Once you have probable cause to believe that a serious physical injury or felony sexual offense kind of crime has occurred, then you have to find by clear and convincing evidence that there is a likelihood of physical injury, danger of physical injury, or sexual victimization. And that is a lower type of injury. And the idea being that someone may have almost killed his wife in the first domestic violence assault. We're not going to say the second time around that we're going to risk that he almost killed her again. But if there's a risk of any kind of injury, that's physical injury, then we are going to be protective of the victim, and we want the court to be protective.
Questions on that? Anyone?
Thank you. How does the victim look what happens right now?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, basically speaking, under the current system, there is presumption in favor of bail. That is, you focus on the likelihood that the individual will appear at trial, and the almost quaint notion that by simply posting a certain amount of money and establishing the likelihood to appear for trial that you're taking care of everything. I say almost quaint in the sense that those notions developed in times with much smaller communities, with much smaller groups of people involved who may have had some sense of how they could secure somebody. The judges do take into consideration the danger to society. They have been able to stretch the consideration. But this strengthens the danger to society and danger to victims' standing. Prosecutors can probably give you a more precise notion than I can as to this particular provision, based on their practical experience.
I guess I'm just trying to find the degree of judgment call on the part of the judge.
Oh, as far as... Mr. Chairman, Mr. Senator Duncan, this will give the judge actually a fairly straightforward standard, because you're going to go through a probable cause determination, which judges are used to making because they make those all the time. You're going to have a standard where you've got a defined violent felony, and that's here is something that judges can readily discern. They also know how to apply clear and convincing evidence standards, because that's the standard that's used routinely in tougher civil cases. It's a tougher civil standard, and it's just below the criminal standard of beyond a reasonable doubt. So the parameters and guidelines here are fairly straightforward as far as what a judge will look at. The hard part is the determination that the danger of physical injury, sexual victimization, that's going to be on a case-by-case basis. But there's a tough standard of proof, clear and convincing evidence.
I'm sorry, not being a lawyer, I guess that my question is, it still falls into the category of judgment call on the part of the judge?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Duncan, yes. We just push them a little harder in the direction of please consider the safety of the victim and safety.
And they have to defend, be able to defend the decision. Who challenges that decision?
Generally, on that issue, it's not challenged because you have to go to a public court.
Right, that's right.
Takes too long. So generally the decision goes unchallenged.
Should I move on to HCR 91?
Please.
This provision has to do with catch up with myself here. The
search and seizure.
Search and seizure provision. The preamble language is in the self-evident. I will tell you what the thrust of this is about and get back to detail as to any responses. The thrust here is that there have been times in the past when the Oregon Supreme Court waxed and moved in the direction of following search and seizure standards of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution and the U.S. Supreme Court decision, and other times when the Oregon Supreme Court has waned away from following those standards. We are in a waning phase right now, apparently. Maybe we're going to wax again. But since the when I began practicing in Oregon in the mid-70s, we were in a waxing phase, and there was a case in 1973 where basically the Oregon Supreme Court said, hey, we just follow the same standards as the federal courts in interpreting search and seizure. But then you moved into the mid-80s, and they were saying, oh, no, we're revisiting our Constitution, and we really see different inherent meanings and the search and seizure provisions of the Oregon Constitution, and we're going to secure evidence under different standards. As prosecutors will tell you, the problem we have in Oregon is inherently one of a lack of a bright-line standard, an understandable standard as to what is admissible and what is not. And yet, this HJR moves us away from something I would like to see us do in some instances. I've often been an advocate of the Oregon way, Oregon doing its own thing and setting its own standard apart from the rest of the United States. Why not? We're a separate state. It's a federal system. That's great. But historically, looking at the Oregon search and seizure provisions in our Constitution, our founding mothers and fathers, the pioneers back in 1859, from the choice of language that they used did not really mean that we would be different in this regard, and if someone wants us to be different in this regard, they ought to amend the Constitution for us to be different. And instead, we've seen judicial interpretations that have pulled us away from the U.S. Supreme Court interpretations of the Fourth Amendment. This is a policy.
This could backfire, though, later on with a new Supreme Court, a U.S. Supreme Court.
It could.
You could have another Warren Court, and suddenly you're stuck with a federal court decision.
And the beauty of that, Mr. Chairman, is that in Oregon, the legislature and the people can have a continuing conversation if we find ourselves in a difficult situation. We know we have the bedrock protections of the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution. Never lose those. They're guaranteed and virtually impossible to change. So we can modify the structure that goes above that bedrock. We can never go below the bedrock, but we can modify the structure. And if we find that we attached ourselves too much to a particular structure, we can detach ourselves. But we do know that no matter how the U.S. Supreme Court always sets the lowest common denominator standard, that is, we cannot go below their standard. We can choose to go above. This says, though, we are going to attach ourselves, and it is a policy choice. And frankly, we have a lot more case law to choose from throughout the United States based on these federal decisions about the Fourth Amendment. And it is a policy choice where many of us say, we'd rather have a bright line standard that's understandable than follow the fuzzy standard, at least that's how prosecutors would describe it, that we presently have in Oregon. And they'll be able to give some detailed examples of how they have a hard time discerning what the tea leaves mean at the bottom of the Supreme Court's cup here in Oregon. Policy check.
Chairman Brown, did you have a question? Or
no.
My comment?
What states have this, I guess, as it is? What states have this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I have to say I don't know. I'm just blithely ignorant of some of these things.
Okay, if we could get through the next two, we have some witnesses that won't be here tomorrow afternoon. So I'd like Kevin will be available tomorrow afternoon, I'm sure.
God willing.
So why don't we go on to 93?
Okay. Is it 93 next or 92?
Excuse me, 92. I'm ahead of them.
92. The essence of 92 is this. Right now in Oregon, for aggravated murder and murder trials, you need a unanimous jury verdict. This says that you still need a unanimous jury verdict for guilt, as well as for the sentencing phase of aggravated murder. But when you drop down a notch to murder, where the death penalty is not an issue, you can have an 11-1 jury verdict to convict. Below that, the present standard is 10-2 jury verdict to convict. For anything below that, that's present standard, and we don't change that. So you'd have a three-tiered system. Instead of jumping from the 10-2 for all criminal trials to convict, where you now jump to 12-zip for murder and aggravated murder, you'd have 10-2 for all criminal cases. You'd move to 11-1 for murder and to 12-0 for the conviction phase of aggravated murder. The sentencing phase of aggravated murder remains unanimous. And that's basically what that's all about.
Could you talk about why this is necessary?
A couple of reasons. One is, just generally speaking, you can have the one objector who will freeze up the whole process. But secondly, this is in part a reaction to the new jury selection methodology that has arisen in the United States, which I think is actually damaging to the whole jury process, and we have a separate talk about that. But where a great deal of effort goes into finding at least one doubting Thomas or doubting Jill on a jury. That is, you go through a real scientific, pseudo-scientific process with experts coming in to help you find at least one person who will just not go along with the case. And if you found that one person, you effectively vetoed the determination of 11 others. Since we already have 10-2 verdicts for all of our other criminal cases, and we seem to do just fine, we could have been more aggressive and said 10-2 here, but we thought we would compromise at 11-1.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
So I guess, are there a lot of murder trials in Oregon that attorneys have lost as a result of this?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I would not say lost. I'd say there have been a number, and the prosecutors will have to give you the specific numbers and case examples. There have been cases where they've been hung up by one juror in these kinds of cases.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Turner.
I haven't other states adopted the 11-1 ratio on homicide.
Mr. Chairman or Senator Turner, I don't know.
It was fine.
Pardon me?
Here we find out.
Yeah, in fact, I would mention that the reason why you're hearing these I don't knows is I focus on what I call the objective merit of each piece. There are others in this process who have all kinds of statistical stuff from around the United States, and like the package that I talked about how we compare to other states, and I rely on them for that part of it. Measure HJR 93, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
The essence of this piece has to do with transactional versus use immunity. You already heard from one attorney about this. The basic idea is that we certainly want to encourage the admission of relevant evidence in cases. We do have this set up so it's subject to statutory evidentiary rules, and we've given, in fact, respect to a process where rules are established. But we also want it understood constitutionally that relevant evidence should be admitted in criminal trials, and that means evidence having any tendency to prove the charge against the criminal defendant or to establish the proper sentence for the criminal defendant. The prosecutors will have some case histories to present to you about the impact of this, but the essential concept has to do with two aspects. I talked about immunity, transaction immunity versus use immunity. Transaction immunity means if you bring in someone and you gather their testimony, anything that relates to that transaction, any transaction involved in that testimony, you can't go after that person on because they've been, in effect, forced to testify against themselves. Use immunity means, well, you can still go after the transaction. You just can't use that testimony against that person. And in Oregon, we have moved in the direction of requiring, in effect, transactional immunity when you use someone's testimony rather than use testimony. And that can lead to the inadvertent protection of much more than you ever expected when you bring about testimony from someone. The prosecutors will also present information to the committee in regard to cases in which other forms of evidence have been kept out. Evidence which they thought was relevant to prove a criminal charge for which under the Oregon interpretation of relevant evidence has been excluded, whereas under U.S. Supreme Court decisions the evidence would have been admitted. I know you're sensitive to time, so we'll move to HCR 94, Mr. Chairman. This is a piece that has to do with empowerment of the court. People might be surprised to hear me say that, but the concern that a number of us have is we already know that you cannot have ex post facto laws if you go back and impose a tougher sanction on somebody who has been sentenced. But we have had situations where you have a type of ex post facto law where you go back and you impose a weaker sanction, even though the judge imposed a certain sentence. This says that if you're going to do that, you need to be able to return to the judiciary and ask them to carry out such a sentence, that there should not be a legislative fiat which is imposed and which across the board reduces sentences which were already imposed by judges. The key phrase begins at line 11, no law shall permit a term of imprisonment imposed by a judge in open court to be set aside or otherwise not carried out except through the subsequent exercise of, and then it says the power of the governor to grant reprieve, we already have that, judicial authority to grant appellate or post-conviction relief. That second part is important. Post-conviction relief can include legislative empowerment or authorization of the court to revisit a sentence, but it has to honor the court and allow the court to make the determination in each given case whether the sentence should be reduced. This has already happened in regard to Measure 11, for example, where certain Measure 11 sentences were revisited by the passage of legislation by the legislature, which called upon the court to take a look at sentences that it already imposed and working with the prosecutor and the defense attorney to decide whether or not the court would reduce the sanction. But the legislature did not just across the board say, yeah, we're going to reduce all of these sentences. The reason for this provision is besides the general concept of victims being empowered and having a right to see that a sentence is carried out, also, loss of confidence in the criminal justice system. When, after somebody's been sentenced, we find out a couple of years later, or maybe 10 years later, the legislature across the board weakens the sanctions, and someone is suddenly released, not because a judge rethought the sentence and reapplied it to the facts of the case, but because someone in an administrative or legislative way just cut across and said, we're going to release these folks. It also means that you're not going to have judicially determined sentences undermined by releases of convenience, which means the criminal justice system better make sure it applies the resources to carry out the sentences as they have been adjudicated by the judges. I would add quickly that the adjudication can include, as it does now, incorporated within it, good time, or an early release concept if the sentence is already meted out with early release is allowed. All right, that's part of the sentence. If there's good time in the statute, all right, that's part of the sentence. But if there isn't, don't go come back later and say we're going to arbitrarily reduce the sentence.
What if there's no good time now, but subsequently there's a good time statute in that?
Then the provision would have to be that the court may resentence that individual if the court wishes to allow the good time.
So they'd have to bring the defendant back to the court and allow the judge to make the decision.
Yes.
Other questions? Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Mannix, in that situation that you're talking about, could the judge at sentencing say that this defendant, this convicted defendant, is eligible for good time? Is the proper correction to determine they, in fact, have earned that good time at the time of the original sentencing, rather than having to bring them back?
Chairman, Mr. Counsel, I'd say that caught me a little off guard on that one, but it sounds to me like a reasonable thing for a judge to do if the judge incorporated that in the sentence at the time. This is trying to respect the judge's determination. And it'd be an interesting argument, but I would say, and I know we're making a legislative record, that we were not specifically contemplating that, but it does not seem to be an unreasonable approach. If the judge has contemplated that at the time, the counter argument would be, no, the judge can talk about all the judge wants to, but unless the judge had the power at the time to carry that out as part of the sentence, but that was more theory rather than reality. But my initial reaction to what you're saying is that if the judge has incorporated that in the sentence and there's no prohibition for the judge to incorporate that as opposed to carrying it out, that would be an appropriate thing for the judge to do. There is a second part of this, though, I do need to mention that's important, and that is that no law shall limit a court's authority to sentence a criminal defendant consecutively for crimes against different victims. That's very important. This does not say the judge must do so. But it does say that if the judge wants to do so, the judge must be allowed to. The court must be allowed to. And we do have laws that have restricted the court's ability to do that. And this says, no, the law may not restrict the court's ability to do that.
Can you give me an example of a current law that restricts the judge's ability?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, my recollection under sentencing guidelines is there are restrictions on consecutive sentences under a number of circumstances. And those who are dealing with this on a daily basis will probably come up with specific case examples. But my understanding is the sentencing guidelines contain an inherent bias against consecutive sentences, and the judge has to jump through some loopholes, jump over some obstacles. This says, you can't limit the judge's authority to sentence for different victims consecutive sentences. And so if the sentencing guidelines contain any such provisos, they would be rendered ineffective.
Other questions on 94? Thank you, Kevin. I think I'll have you stop there so we can get to these other witnesses that won't be available tomorrow.
I appreciate your courtesies, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you. I'd ask Justice Peterson, Professor Steve Cantor, Arwin Bird, and Brian Johnson come forward, please. Well, Justice Peterson, why don't we start with you? I understand you want to address HJR 89.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Edwin Peterson. I'm a former Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Oregon. And I'm here today to speak in opposition to HJR 89. The significant provision that brings me here is a provision that would require, in order to serve on a criminal jury, all jurors would have to be registered to vote in Oregon. Now, as you all know, the Constitution of Oregon guarantees the right of jury trial in civil and criminal cases, and of course the antecedent of that is the Constitution of the United States, which contains a similar guarantee. You don't have to look very far into history to know that the underlying public policy for those constitutional provisions was that if people are charged with crimes or if they bring actions in a civil court, they should be heard by a jury of their peers, a cross-section of the community. Now, according to the Secretary of State's office, 15.6% of all persons eligible to vote don't register. There are a lot of reasons for that. Voter apathy is probably pretty high on the list. Now, there's no right, there's no constitutional right, I suppose, to serve on a jury, but serving on a jury is certainly a very important privilege, and it should be open to all. If there's one area of public service that is universally acclaimed, it is serving on a jury. People who serve on a jury almost invariably state that it was a positive experience for them. It gives them confidence in the government. Now, there's a further aspect of this that I'd like to touch upon. Between 1992 and 1994, it was my good fortune to be the chair of a task force appointed by the Supreme Court looking into the problems of minorities in the judicial system. And that task force report states, I'm quoting from page 78, "The extent to which minorities have been underrepresented in juries has been the subject of considerable research. A consensus exists that American jury systems tend to overrepresent white, middle-aged, suburban, middle-class people and underrepresent other groups. Consistent with that finding, the task force recommended, they had two recommendations concerning service on juries. Recommendation number 7-2 was directed to the Legislative Assembly and encouraged the legislature to consider legislation to change the method of selecting persons to be included in the source list for possible jury service in order to include more minorities in the jury pool. And I might say parenthetically that that's been the trend in almost every state in the United States, to broaden the pool from which jurors are chosen. Recommendation number 7-1 was directed to the Chief Justice, who has some authority under a statute, under ORS 10.215. The Chief Justice has the authority to decide what list should be looked at and determine where the jury will be selected from. And the task force recommended that the Chief Justice implement changes to broaden the pool. Such changes might include the use of public utility customer lists, city directories, tribal rolls, and income tax lists. Now, I practiced law in Portland for 22 years, and I tried a lot of lawsuits. One year alone, I tried, I think, over 25 jury cases. And I question whether it's been demonstrated that in order to, quote, protect the rights of crime victims to justice, I'm quoting from HCR 89, people who are not registered to vote should not serve on juries. Or to state it otherwise, what evidence is there that the rights of crime victims have been eroded because people who are not registered to vote serve on juries? I respectfully submit that we should return to the system that existed pre-1989 and permit all adult citizens to serve on juries, with exceptions for people who have been convicted of a felony, of course. That's the end of my remarks. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity of addressing you.
Other questions to the Justice Peterson on HR 89?
Mr. Chair,
yes,
maybe Justice Peterson addressed this wise to the government. I guess Representative Maddox was concerned that by limiting the jury pool to that of registered voters, that we get the most responsible citizens on jury pools, and I'd just like to get your response to that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, I don't agree on the basic premise there. I don't think that it's been established that simply because somebody doesn't register to vote, that person is less responsible than someone who does. And furthermore, I say this with a little bit of trepidation, but it seems to me that when you make that sort of separation, there's a sort of elitism that's involved. There's no requirement in law that people register to vote. Obviously, everybody should register to vote. But I just don't agree with the major premise that underlies that statement as Representative Mannix.
I just want to send a crazy question. If the defendant was a non-voter, he had a jury of only voters, is he being tried by his peers? That's kind of superficial.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson, that's of course a legal point that probably would be a civic at some point. I have no opinion on that.
I shouldn't have asked.
He's back in the best.
Why don't we go next to Professor Cantor, I understand, is going to discuss with us HR 91 and 93. Is that correct?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll make a few brief comments about that. I can't resist, however, since I've come down from being released from jury duty this afternoon. I am on jury duty in Multnomah County to say one thing about the jury provision. I am a registered voter, but nonetheless, I share Justice Peterson's concern about this measure. And I would point out in response to a couple of comments that were made that way back in 1880, the United States Supreme Court in Strotter versus West Virginia said that citizens do have a right to serve on juries. In that particular case, there was a flat rule excluding black people from jurors. In 1880, the Supreme Court said that was unconstitutional, partly out of concern for the defendant, but largely out of concern for the prospective juror. One can remember that it was not until 1954 that segregation in general was held to violate the Equal Protection Clause. So jury service is considered to be a very fundamental part of citizenship. I read in the Multnomah County jury pamphlet, which I assume is accurate, the instructions to all of us, that Thomas Jefferson felt that jury service was the most important responsibility of citizens, even more so than the vote. So I would urge that you not cut back. We ought to be broadening participation, not reducing participation.
Senator Duncan.
Just a question of curiosity. I realize you've been called to jury duty, but have you been asked to sit? As a law professor, I'm curious if they would want you on there.
Not so far, but I'll say. Although I've told everybody I don't know any more than the rest of them. Very briefly and generally with respect to HJR 91 and 93, I'm sorry to say that in my opinion, in some ways these two measures are perhaps the most insidious of what I consider to be a generally poor lot of measures before the legislature. And the basic reasons for that is that although these measures are rather wordy and they repeat the preamble that Representative Mannix mentioned as some general purposes, essentially what they purport to do is act as stealth repealers of two of the original Bill of Rights provisions of the Oregon Constitution, Article 1, Section 9, and Article 1, Section 12. And I just happened to come across, I wish it were actually the original, it would be worth something, but at least the Xerox copy of our original Constitution in Oregon. And I think it's noteworthy that until relatively recent years, there were no serious attempts to substantially modify or particularly repeal provisions of the Bill of Rights. That has begun to change in recent years, and I think it's a very dangerous and short-sighted trend. Now, why do I suggest that these act as stealth repealers, although I think there is some problem in some of the drafting language? Nonetheless, the gravamen of each of these provisions is to say that the particular section of the Oregon Constitution, whether it's Section 9 or Section 12, has the same force and effect as a provision of the federal Constitution, and no further. What that means is, I take it the objective of the proponents of this, is to remove any judicial effect from these measures. Because anything that they might do would already have to be being done under the federal constitution. And I think this really does invert our system of federalism, depreciate the importance of Oregon's constitution and Oregon's institutions. We have three federal branches of government and three branches of government in Oregon, legislative, judicial, and executive. And I think it's crucially important that we not cede authority of any of those three branches to the federal branch of government. The federal branch of government has its proper role and proper place in our federalist system. So too do each of the branches in Oregon. And the import of these measures is to take away the independent content of the Oregon Bill of Rights and to take away the final authority of the Oregon Supreme Court to give a binding interpretation of those Bill of Rights measures. Now, I know there are some who suggest that the Oregon Supreme Court invented, I've heard dates like 1982, invented in 1982 an independent interpretation of the Oregon Bill of Rights. That, of course, is far from the case. It's a very limited reading of history. And let me just take a minute to remind you of some history about the Bill of Rights. First of all, when the Federal Bill of Rights was written by James Madison and adopted in 1791, it was clearly agreed by all that the Federal Bill of Rights were intended only as limits on federal government power. And it was assumed and accepted that state bills of rights were the critical protections for state citizens against their own state governments. It was only because of the defect of slavery in our system and the inability of some states to protect its own citizens that we had a civil war, and we ultimately had the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, which to some extent changed federalism and said for the first time, in some instances, some of the states, unfortunately, have not proven trustworthy in protecting all of their citizens' rights, and therefore we are going to impose minimum federal guarantees, but we still expect that the states will be free to go further than this minimum floor of protection of individual rights. And a very important component of federalism continued to be the reliance primarily on state constitutions for the protection of individual rights of individual citizens in each state. And this continued to be the case for a very long period of time. If you remember, it was not until the 1960s that most of the federal Bill of Rights provisions that we're talking about here today, the Fourth, Fifth, Sixth Amendments, the Eighth Amendment as well, that anybody really made a successful argument that they should have any significant application against the states. The First Amendment had earlier been incorporated, but it was really the Mapp case in the Fourth Amendment, Miranda, Malloy versus Hogan and Miranda with respect to the Fifth Amendment, Gideon versus Wainwright, of course, with respect to the Sixth Amendment, so on and so forth. So really, the history until the 1960s had been in Oregon and in virtually every other state in this country, that the state Supreme Court was relying primarily upon the state Bill of Rights. So it was only for a very brief period of time, from about the mid-60s until through the 70s pretty much, that the U.S. Supreme Court was moving so rapidly, and many of the proponents of the current measure were objecting to those moves by the U.S. Supreme Court, that state courts, for a while, I think, to their discredit, tended to forget the importance of their own Bill of Rights and began to just parrot what the U.S. Supreme Court was saying. So really, if you look at history in the big picture and you look at the institutional responsibility of the court in our own state, the history is quite the contrary and supports the notion that we ought to be adamantly in support of keeping our own Bill of Rights. The framers of our Constitution said some things specifically about this. They glorified the Federal Bill of Rights, but Mr. Smith, who was the prime mover of the Oregon Bill of Rights and who looked particularly to Indiana's Constitution and drawing upon another state's Bill of Rights, pointed out that we had some experience in 1789 and 1791, and as good as those documents were, that further experience led to an even improved version. They described the Bill of Rights of Indiana as gold refined. It's up with the progress of the age. Further, he said, I remember a great many things which people held entirely Republican and right, which subsequent experience and the progress of the age taught us are blots upon our escutcheon. The idea of the Oregon Bill of Rights was to set out for Oregon, guaranteed by Oregonians and by Oregon courts, basic individual human rights, limitations on the majority that might act in its short-sighted occasions in ways that were not in the long-term benefit of the state. So I urge you to protect the essential character of the Oregon Bill of Rights and reject these two measures. There may be an occasional Oregon Supreme Court decision that one or another of you on the committee disagrees with, or one of the proponents of one of these measures disagree with, or that I disagree with. But that is not a reason to throw the institutional baby out with the bathwater, and that's what these measures do. Now, even within their own terms, there are a couple of puzzling aspects about them, which I think raise additional serious problems and ought to give you pause before you move forward. If you look at HJR 93, for example, it says that Section 12 should be given the same effect and force as the Fifth Amendment. There's some irony in that because, of course, Section 12 is not even completely parallel to the Fifth Amendment. There are provisions of the Fifth Amendment that have nothing to do with Section 12. The Takings Clause, to give one example, the Due Process Clause, which has been interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court to include substantive due process, which our Supreme Court has not gotten itself involved in, I think to the credit of our court, given our Constitution. And so we don't even have the language parallel that is there with respect to Section 9, I would say, with respect to the Fourth Amendment. So you have a very confusing aspect to that. Secondly, in many ways, the sentence right after the main operative sentence in each of these measures turns normal constitutional hierarchy on its head. And the only thing that I can think of that's a parallel is the draft constitution I looked at in Kazakhstan before I helped work on it. I haven't seen anything in any American constitution that would do this. It says, this is a constitutional provision, all relevant evidence subject to statutory evidentiary rules shall be admitted. What it is saying is, if this constitutional provision means anything after this amendment, it is saying the Constitution is subservient to ordinary law. That's exactly the opposite of what we ought to be doing. The Constitution is supposed to be the long-term, abiding, transcendent principles and values that express the long-term, thoughtful view of a people. The statutes change as policy changes, as conditions changes. But in order to make a change in the Constitution, normally we don't say that, well, here's a right, except as provided by law. That's exactly what Kazakhstan did. They were trying to bring themselves into a more modern rule of law system, and they wanted to give all these rights, so they copied a bunch of our rights, and they said, well, everybody has a right to free speech, except as provided by law. That's, of course, no right at all. And that's the kind of language we have here. I'm not suggesting it would have that interpretation. It's not clear to me what interpretation this really would have, but it points out this is not carefully thought out. It's not consistent with the normal, appropriate hierarchy of constitutional structure. And I would ask you to think about, although I'm not claiming that the analogy is anywhere near perfect, but particularly for Republican members of this committee, who I think ought to be most concerned about the form of these two amendments, whatever one agrees or disagrees about on policy. Suppose there was a measure that said that there was a governor that everybody didn't like, or a particular legislature that the people didn't like, or a party that the people got fed up with, and they said, the governor shall not take action on a series of areas inconsistent with the action of the President of the United States, or the legislature shall not take any action inconsistent with the action of the federal Congress. Those of us that believe in federalism and its important long-term effect would find that appalling, just like I suspect the voters would find these measures appalling if they were listed for what their true purpose is, if they said, this is a repealer of Article 1, Section 9. We're taking out the protection of unreasonable search and seizure from our Constitution. This is a repealer of the former jeopardy provisions and the self-incrimination provisions in our Constitution, which I think is the fair way to read what the intent really is.
Yes, my problem.
I could listen to this kind of testimony for hours because it's very intriguing, and I think it's a very interesting aspect of law. One thing I'm kind of curious about, because I've been on the impression for years that Oregon search and seizure laws are more stringent than the majority of other states around our country, and primarily maybe it's brought about because of Escobedo and the memoranda and the impact it's had on the ability to prosecute cases of evidence that may have been seized improperly or properly or whatever the case may be. But am I wrong, or is Oregon comparable to other states in the search and seizure laws, or are we, in fact, a little bit more stringent?
Well, I would say that we have been among the states in the last 15 or 20 years which has been willing to look at issues freshly, even if they've been cited by the U.S. Supreme Court. There are some courts that just haven't done that at all. But I certainly don't think we're out of the mainstream. I think there are areas where the Oregon court, rightly or wrongly, has found that the individual protections of the Oregon Bill of Rights should give additional privacy protections, particularly, and some self-incrimination protections, and some form of jeopardy protections to individuals that the U.S. Supreme Court may currently not be willing to give. But the mere fact that the U.S. Supreme Court decides the case doesn't make it right for all time and all place. And, there are decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court I agree with and disagree with. There are decisions of the Oregon Supreme Court I agree with and disagree with. The fundamental point is that institutionally, the state Bill of Rights must have vitality, and the proper guardian of the Bill of Rights is, in our system, the Oregon Supreme Court, not the Supreme Court in Washington, D.C.
Thank you.
It helps that your experience in front of the legislature has been as stimulating for you as my experience in law school was for me. And with that, I appreciate your legal analysis. I think some of us have concerns about the political analysis, and we have very low integrity rating with the Oregon voters, and because one of the reasons that's been mentioned is that we don't always respect the will of the voters, and sometimes I think we earn that. But in this case, these measures passed in total in ballot measure 40 by 59% of the Oregonians that voted in that particular election. I guess I would just ask you, don't you think it would be politically wise for us to make corrections and then send it out to the voters?
Well, I think that is a difficult issue. I would say a couple of things, however. First of all, we do not live in a democracy by design, not a pure democracy. Democracy is a very important part of our system, but we live in a limited democracy in two ways. First, most of our decisions get made by a representative body rather than by direct vote. We do have the initiative petition process that leavens that somewhat in Oregon. But second, and very importantly, we have constitutional limitations on what the majority, in its short-term, sometimes misguided passion, may want to do. And that is really the genius of our system that has held us together in such good form for several hundred years, and in Oregon for 140 years. And I do think that the legislature has a responsibility not just to act as a conduit through which these measures come and go back. And I would not put as much stock in the vote of the people on the last measure as others might, partly for the reason that the Supreme Court declared them unconstitutional. It was a grab bag measure that had a very appealing label to it. And unfortunately, I think that realistically, a measure that is labeled as being about victims' rights, as being strong on crime, is likely to do very well in a public election. I wish, and I know there have been some efforts and some statutory improvements this session, but I wish that the legislature would spend more of its time on really developing serious statutory proposals that could help victims in reality. Instead of passing through measures or aiding and abetting a process to allow the people to pass through measures that they believe are going to help victims, that do nothing for victims. And I've made this come in a number of different places. It's a little bit off track, but I would like to see us move to a system where we get to firmer trial setting dates. That would help prospective jurors. It would help prospective victims. They don't have to show up 3 or 4 or 5 times thinking they're going to trial and not get to trial. I'd like to see you, and I know that the number of you have been making some efforts, and others in the legislature, improving our restitution system for victims, doing things that will actually increase the dignity with which victims may be dealt with in the system without undermining individual liberties for the accused or for the rest of us, without unduly aggrandizing power of prosecutors. Prosecutors, of course, are very honorable people, doing a good job, trying to do a good job, but of course, they would like as much authority and discretion as possible. That's natural. It's human nature. They will tell you, well, we'll exercise it effectively. We'll exercise it carefully. I've heard a few of those comments already today. And in most cases, they do, just like the police do. But there are reasons why we have historical Bill of Rights limits, and I think it is very short-sighted to begin to sacrifice those in the name of making it a little bit easier or making it sound a little bit better to the public. And I think the public will understand the legislature that has the courage to say, you know what, these measures are all wet. These are not going to accomplish what you really want. Let's work together and do something serious about the level of violence in our society and about the problems that victims do face and that other people in our society face. Some progress has been made in that area, as I say, and I think more can be made in the future. So I don't think you should lockstep feel obligated just to pass measures out, especially measures that are ill considered, as I believe these are.
I'm curious, did you give the same testimony in the House committee?
I gave testimony opposed to earlier versions of these, yes.
You said that 91 and 93 were self-repealers of Sections 9 and 12 of Article 1 of the Constitution. I don't have the Constitution right in front of me, but I presume they're the sections that are relevant to the subject matter of these two HCRs.
Yes.
Do you think if we decide to avoid confusion, if we decide from a policy standpoint to go ahead with these HCRs, that we should be... that we should repeal those sections to be consistent?
I think it's more honest. I mean, I think if you're, you know, if the voters are really going to tackle this issue, that's the more direct and honest way to do it. I would not urge the legislature to send out repealers, but I do think that would be a more straightforward, honest way, and, you know, I would hope that the voters would have the good sense if that came to not repeal either measure.
Well, to follow up, I mean, it actually came from obviously I'm not speaking in favor of repealing them either, but from the sense of being confusing, if one part of the Constitution gives certain rights and then the other part of the Constitution, which this would be, undermines those rights, wouldn't that be very confusing unless one of those were either not done or were repealed?
I agree. No, I, as I say, I think that would be the more honest way to tackle the issue if it's got to be handled that way.
Thank you.
Chairman, I just respond to Senator Brown. You refer to this poll that was taken, the 5% approval. I'm going to have to get you a copy of that poll that I think will actually show you that the people have far greater trust in the legislature than that newspaper article led us to believe. I just want to,
thank you.
Your
we need your here.
But I want more than doom and gloom, you know.
Yeah. Well, and with that introduction, we have a former representative who now is just basking in all kinds of favorable treatment and people's view of my talk about HDR 94. Tell us how your life has improved from a public perspective since you're no longer an elected official.
How much time do you have, Senator? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much for this opportunity to testify. My name is Brian Johnston. I live here in Salem. And I was asked if I would pick one of these measures, and actually it was assigned to me, 94, and it was easy to do because I opposed them all so vehemently. I was glad to take any one piece of it. I want to say a couple things. First of all, this is my first appearance in this legislative session. I tried to avoid this, and I come over because I hope that I was motivated because I thought it might make a difference, and I think that I have a lot of respect for this committee, and no, Senator, I did not testify in the House. Second, I'd like to reveal some of my bias just generally before I get to my remarks. I think that I have three reasons why I'm opposed to this entire package and am opposed to Measure 40. I think it misleads the public, it overly simplifies a complex problem, and it's counterindicated by the available research. But having said that, I'm willing to talk about the individual matters. First, I want to say one comment about HCR 89 that Justice Peterson talked about. 24 years ago, I was a VISTA in Chicago, and my assignment was at the legal aid office at 47th Martin Luther King Drive. And there I represented a large number of folks who were being evicted from the Chicago Housing Authority. And the legal aid organization did something against my advice. They took on some impact litigation to change the way the panels of tenants were selected to vote on whether or not to evict someone. And what was happening was that you started with a panel of nine, five tenants and four Chicago Housing Authority officials. And then if any of the tenants didn't show up, you just went ahead. So there might be only two tenants and four. The housing officials, of course, always showed up. And so there might be only two tenants. And the legal aid sued them and said, you can't do that. You've got to have more tenants than you have housing authority officials. And I said, I don't really think that's in our best interest because the housing authority officials were, I thought, fair. Well, make a long story short, we won the litigation, and from that point forward, only those housing residents that were willing to serve on these tenant panels and indicated they were willing got an invite to serve on these panels. The eviction rates went up 50%. And they went up because all of a sudden you had people who were willing to serve on these tenant things. They were much, much harsher than the administration, housing official administration had been. So at any rate, I use that as an argument, I think, for the involving the jury of the peers. The other piece I want to point out before I say my one thing about the measure I was asked to talk about is a book I'd like to recommend to you. I know you're not doing much by way of reading. And the book is called Paradise Lost, California's Experience and America's Future. And it's a 1998 book, and it's now available, I just learned today when I checked it on the net, on paperback. And it's written by an admittedly liberal columnist named Peter Schrag, who covers politics in Sacramento. But what it's about is the direct democracy experiment, picking up exactly on where former Dean Cantor had been a moment ago. Direct democracy has had some interesting ramifications in the last 10 years because it is because of the use of it in these last 10 years. And Peter Schrag's point is that it has straitjacketed California. And I would suggest that it is doing the same thing to Oregon because of uses like the one that's in front of you today. And I would recommend that book to you. Finally, turning my attention to HCR 94. 94 is the measure that says you can't change, if the sentence is announced in court, you can't change it. Okay? A moment ago, the sponsor said that, and I'm quoting, not because he doesn't want to change some other way. He doesn't want to change by the legislature and not because, quote, this is the quote, not because the judge rethought the sentence. Well, in the House, they tried to add a minority that would have allowed the sentencing judge himself to make the change. And that minority report wasn't adopted. I'm saying that the minority report from the House should be adopted. And they had two changes in it. One was that the sentencing judge could revisit the sentence. And you could do that with some limited time if you want it. But if the sentencing judge encounters new information that wasn't available to him or for her or had some thought that wasn't available to him or her at the time, they should have the authority to make that change. This measure, as it is, would not allow it. The legislature, the sponsor said early in his testimony that he recognized that you have a responsibility to exercise your independent judgment. Well, this measure, of course, takes away that responsibility because it wouldn't allow you to do that. It wouldn't allow the legislature to make a change that affected sentences. And I think perhaps
most using again the self metaphor, the most interesting piece is that it also wouldn't allow the voters to change null sentences. Let's say that the voters had a, you know, all the evidence isn't in for the sentencing reforms that we've done. I think that we will start to collect that evidence that some of the people we've sent to prison for extended periods of time, that some, myself included, might argue are excessive for the particular circumstances of that individual. We will learn more about them when we see their recidivism rates after they serve those sentences, and when we see how they meld themselves back into society after they return from a sentence that some of us might consider to be unfair. At any rate, when we pick that information up, let's say that something that is merely hypothetical were to occur, and that the voters were to reconsider on one of these sentencing measures. Let's say that they reconsidered on Measure 11, for example, and that sentences on those types, on some of those offenses were changed. Well, under the provision that is HJR 94, that wouldn't affect any of the people who were sentenced under it, because that would be a law, and that law might change it prospectively, but it wouldn't affect those people who were already serving it. So even the voters under this couldn't change. This, I think, raises righteousness to a new level. It says, not only are we right when we've dealt with this, not only have we figured out everything, but we have fixed it so that nobody else can change it. And that's interesting, because I also quote the sponsor earlier in his testimony when he said, there could be circumstances that we have not foreseen. Well, that's right, there could be those circumstances. And HBR 94 prevents anyone from considering those circumstances. And I think that it's a disservice to Oregonians, and clearly a disservice that I hope that you will not allow to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Question for Brian. Thank you for your testimony. You'll have to come again.
In my plans.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Arwen Bird, and I am the president of SAFE, Survivors Advocating for an Effective System. I'm here today to testify against HJR 87-94. These resolutions are not needed amendments, nor would their implementation aid in balancing the criminal justice system. 7 of the 8 do not address crime survivors' rights. They only degrade Oregon's Bill of Rights. As a survivor of a near-fatal collision caused by a drunk driver, I have a unique perspective. During the pretrial hearings and trial for the man who hit me, my family and I participated in that we were notified and attended various stages of the proceedings. We also read statements at his sentencing. These are reasonable rights for crime victims, to be heard, to receive restitution, and to be notified of proceedings. These are rights that need to be enacted in statute, not in the Constitution. I support Senate Bill 841 to this end. The other so-called crime victims' rights of HJR 88 through 94 have nothing to do with crime victims. They have everything to do with jeopardizing each of our constitutional rights. Changing the rules of evidence, jury composition, and a non-unanimous verdict in murder cases would have no direct benefit for someone such as myself, a survivor of crime. As a citizen, I urge you to consider the constitutionality of the legislation before you. It would be an injustice to your constituents for you to vote favorably on legislation that you are aware is faulty. As a survivor, I do not feel that this legislation would be effective. Oregon needs an effective and sustainable criminal justice system, a system that upholds the civil rights of defendants while balancing the important perspective of the victim. At each step, with each piece of legislation, we must be conscious of an effort to create an effective criminal justice system. These resolutions do not further this goal. Please consider my thoughts as a survivor who sincerely believes in preventing further victimization. Thank you. Do you have any questions?
Questions. Thanks for your testimony and your patience.
No problem.
What we'll do, I know that both the proponents and the opponents have additional testimony. We'll take that tomorrow after the Attorney General's testimony. He's scheduled at 3 o'clock. And so we will be adjourned until then.